This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Available now on the documentary from the BBC World Service.
I'm Jude Shapiro. I'm following the chaplains of Heathrow Airport. I'll be discovering what happens when faith, flight, and the stresses of Europe's busiest airport combine.
People are so often placed in our path just at the right time.
Listen now by searching for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks. We're starting the programme with a momentous decision by judges at the International Criminal Court to issue arrest warrants for Israel's Prime Minister and former Defence Minister, as well as the military commander of Hamas. It's momentous because of the crimes that are alleged and because of just who are the accused. On that, pretty much everyone agrees, whatever they think of the court and its decision. As you'll hear, there are supporters of the move and those in Israel who say it's an utter disgrace. The charges against Hamas will take up less of our time, as at least two of the three men against whom the ICC prosecutors sought arrest warrants are dead, and Israel claims that the remaining man, Mohammed Deif, it has also managed to kill. The three had been sought for their involvement in the massacre of October the 7th last year, in which about 1,200 Israelis were killed. Many others were raped and abducted. The charges against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the former Defence Minister Yoav Gallant are over the war which followed, that they bear responsibility for the war crime of starvation as a method of warfare, and of various crimes against humanity, the calculated destruction of part of the civilian population of Gaza, of inhumane acts, of persecution. The judges today have been considering events up to the 20th of May this year. So what about the humanitarian situation now? Hisham Mana is working in central Gaza with the International Committee of the Red Cross. He told the BBC the picture was dire and deteriorating.
In the northern governorate of Gaza, where civilians for several weeks have been suffering from shortage of food, drinking water supplies, they are living in constant fear amidst explosions and displacement with no proper access to functional hospitals. We haven't seen or witnessed a clear evidence of starvation, yet we are receiving reports, particularly from the hospitals in the northern governorate, of a number of cases who died because of acute malnutrition. In general, there's severe hardships in finding flour and bread.
Hisham Mana from the Red Cross in Gaza. As for Israel, where there's been broad, not universal by any means, but broad condemnation of the judges issuing the arrest warrant. Lending her voice to that, Ruth Wasserman Lande. She's a former member of the Knesset with the opposition Blue and White Party.
It's an absolute travesty. And God knows, I mean, the opposition. I don't belong to the Netanyahu coalition. I don't agree with the Netanyahu coalition. It has absolutely nothing to do with left or right. There's a moral confusion in the world currently with this manifestation of a very strange way of bringing justice.
The judges, as far as I can see, they certainly have not said that Israel does not have a right to defend itself. What they are saying is that the way in which Israel has conducted that war, that is what they say provides reasonable grounds to believe that war crimes and crimes against humanity have been committed. So it's not about Israel's right for self-defense. It's about how you're waging the war.
There has been not a targeting of civilians, but rather a precise attack against Hamas operatives who operate precisely and on purpose amidst civilian Gazan populations under kindergartens, under UNRWA headquarters, with UNRWA cooperation and being completely complicit in the crimes. Those are the ones that deserve to be aimed by the high courts of justice in the world as perpetrators of war crimes.
There are several accusations which the judges say deserve to be heard in court. To take just one of them, and that is that the chamber, the judges, find reasonable grounds to believe that Mr. Netanyahu and Mr. Gallant and I quote here, bear criminal responsibility for the war crime of starvation as a method of warfare. You're saying it's a travesty beyond belief. Absolutely. You will also explain. You will also be aware that for many, many months now, some of your closest allies have been expressing deep concern about the humanitarian situation in Gaza and the Israeli role in that. They feel that Israel has not been doing anywhere near enough and perhaps in some way blocking access to aid.
I would love to answer that because I actually dealt with this very, very specifically and hands-on. There is absolute no starvation of Gazan civilians, definitely not a policy nor a blocking of the aid. In fact, there are hundreds of truckloads of aid sitting and waiting for distribution by United Nations and international organizations just outside of Gaza. But there's been an absolute systematic stealing of the humanitarian aid by the Hamas operatives and stealing the help and the aid from their own civilians. And the Gazan civilians have been testifying on video, to the point of not being afraid of being killed by Hamas, that they are being chopped hands and feet for daring to take their own humanitarian aid.
Ruth, you did just say that there is no policy of blocking the aid. I spoke to an Israeli minister on air who said to me about northern Gaza, this was a few weeks ago, he said, we have created a blockade with our forces. We've prevented supplies from entering the blockaded region where Hamas was trying to regroup. This practice of blockade is legal.
No, there has not been a blocking. What is happening in a very certain area of the northern part of the Gaza Strip, this particular area is a hotbed of Hamas operatives with
underground tunnels. Well, maybe so, but there are still tens of thousands of civilians there.
Just a second, sir, with your permission. These civilians, in inverted commas, are there because the horrific Hamas operatives are chopping their feet and arms and not allowing them to move out with a convoy of Israeli soldiers that are there to defend their way against the Hamas in order to move to safety. Israel has nothing to gain from starving the population. It is not a policy, nor an ideology, nor does it serve any interest. On the contrary, just international criticism. We don't want that.
And that was Ruth Wasserman-Lande from the opposition Blue and White Party in Israel. One of the striking aspects to the statement from the judges explaining why they've agreed to issue the arrest warrants is not just the seriousness of the crimes, but the level of detail that they go into. Adil Haq is a professor of law at Rutgers University in the United States. What does he make of the language?
So the statement released by the court does contain a striking level of detail that really gives us a window not only into the result that the judges reached, but the reasoning that they used to reach that result, and even some indication of the types of evidence that they were relying on. And I think this is an attempt by the judges to recognize the complexity and the sheer number of legal issues raised by these allegations, and really an attempt to explain their reasoning to the public and to victims and affected communities as best as they can without obviously disclosing confidential evidence by witnesses on the ground.
One of the issues that often comes up is as to whether the ICC, the International Criminal Court, does have jurisdiction in this case. A, because Israel is not a signatory to the Rome Statute, but B, because the state of Palestine, the plaintiff, does not exist.
Sure. So the court has essentially said two things. The first is that its prior decisions already established that Palestine's accession to the Rome Statute was legally valid, and that the effect of the accession is that the court has jurisdiction over any international crime committed by a Palestinian national or on the territory of Palestine, which includes both Gaza and the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, and that that prior ruling is sufficient basis for issuing these arrest warrants.
Does Israel have an argument that, look, we've got perfectly fine, robust, functioning courts. Our ability to investigate ourselves trumps the ICC's need to stick its nose in?
So under the ICC statute, what is important is not the capacity of a state to investigate allegations, but whether the state is actually investigating those allegations against the same individuals for substantially the same conduct. So if the Israeli legal system were to open serious, credible, good faith investigations of Prime Minister Netanyahu and former Defense Minister Gallant for substantially the same conduct, then indeed, the international court would step back and allow Israel's legal system to take the lead as long as it is pursued in good faith.
There are, of course, 124 signatories to the Rome Statute. Is there any potential legal jeopardy for those countries that might be allies of Israel, supporters of Israel, material supporters? So in other words, they may be helping Israel with arms supplies, given that these judges are clearly expressing concern about the way in which Israel is prosecuting its war at the moment.
There is. So under the Rome Statute, there is a form of criminal liability, which involves making an intentional contribution to a common plan that involves the commission of other international crimes with knowledge of those crimes. So in principle, leaders of other governments who supply weapons or other important material, understanding Israel's military strategy, even if it does not intend for those crimes to be committed, there is potential legal jeopardy under the Rome Statute.
Adil, I don't know if this is part of your brief as the legal expert that you are, but I just wonder what you think might be the implications of today's decision for the judges to issue the arrest warrants, just in terms of the sort of the international view of the court. I mean, yes, clearly there's been a very strong reaction out of Israel and to a certain extent out of the United States, but one of the things that has often been flung at the court is that it has a double standard of justice and that Western-leaning countries that claim to be democracies or pride themselves on being democracies are not given as hard a time as some other countries. Given what we've seen today, do you think that that may change the view of some of those skeptics of the court?
I hope so. I think many people around the world will look at today's decision as an example of the court applying the law equally to both Hamas and Israel. Unfortunately, the reaction from Israel and to some extent from the United States is an attempt to muddy that picture and present the court as having some sort of anti-Israel bias. And that's really a disservice to Israeli victims, I think, because the warrant issued against the Hamas leader is really a vindication of Israeli victims and a statement by the court that they have rights under international law. And the court exists for them as well, for Israeli victims as well as Palestinian victims.
Adil Haque, Professor of Law at Rutgers University in the United States. Much more about this, of course, on our website, bbc.com/news. You're listening to NewsHour. Coming up on the programme, we have a rather unusual art auction.
At $5 million for the banana, here it is. These are words I never thought I'd say. $5 million for a banana. Don't let it slip away.
A comedian as well as an auctioneer. We'll have more about that banana and how much it was worth towards the end of the programme. Our headlines this hour. As we've been hearing, Israel and the United States have reacted with anger to the International Criminal Court's decision to order the arrest of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for war crimes. The ICC says that member states have an obligation to comply with warrant. And federal police in Brazil have indicted the former president Jair Bolsonaro in connection with an alleged attempt to overthrow his successor. More on that in about 20 minutes. You're with the BBC World Service and live from London, this is NewsHour with me, Tim Franks. One thing has been painfully clear in Ukraine since Russia began its full-scale invasion, now all of 1,002 days ago. It's that the Russian military is prepared to use massive ordnance against targets right across Ukraine. Today, the question was whether the Russians had just taken this to the next level. The Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, said that the eastern city of Dnipro had been hit with something that seemed to be an intercontinental ballistic missile. Since then, President Putin has gone on Russian state TV to say that it was a new type of intermediate range missile, and that it was in response to this week's decision by the US and the UK to allow the longer range weaponry they're supplying to be used by Ukraine to hit targets deep inside Russia. Justin Crump is a military analyst and CEO of the risk strategy group Sibeline. What's the significance of Russia using this new type of missile?
I mean, obviously, people were very alarmed waking up to headlines here on the US East Coast, at least, of, you know, ICBM targets Ukraine from Russia. It's not sort of not what you want to be waking up to. And obviously, that appears to have been overstated. You know, clearly, we now understand it is an IRBM. Still a new type of weapon being used in this conflict. It's a step on from the tactical missiles like the Kinzhal, which has been used since the start of operations in Ukraine. And clearly a signal from the Russians that they're prepared to up the ante in what they are doing, that they have other weapons capabilities, and of course a nod towards their nuclear capability. They've stressed this as a conventional system, not a nuclear system, but obviously that's something they're still trying to alarm the West with, the spectre of nuclear use. So it is an escalation. It's in response, of course, to the attack-ums and storm shadow use inside Russia that's now been authorized and other developments in recent days. And it's the Russians sort of saying, look, we have other things we can do here, and demonstrating that. But it is an experimental system. And of course, Russia's had problems with its high-end military technology of maintaining production in the face of sanctions, and they can work around that. There are obviously limitations to how much they can build, how many they can build. And really, it's a demonstration of intent, I think, rather than a capability that we'll see used again and again against Ukraine versus the cheaper methods Russia's been using, like the drones.
The other thing that President Putin had to say was Russia has the right to use its weapons against military installations of those countries that allow their weapons to be used against Russian facilities. It seems to be a fairly direct threat. How do you think that's going to be going down in Washington and London?
Well, I mean, if it sounds alarming, it's meant to be alarming, but it's one thing to make these statements and Russia's rewritten its nuclear doctrine. I mean, make almost nightly threats against the UK in particular, threatening nuclear annihilation. It's almost how they start the evening news, you know, every evening, sort of death to London and, you know, now the weather. So some of these things lose meaning when they've been repeated so often. And that's dangerous, because you keep hearing this and eventually people say, well, the Russians are always just bluffing, and maybe at some point they're not. And it's that shred of doubt that they want to sow in our minds. But the reality is, Russia says it's fighting all of NATO in Ukraine. It knows it isn't. And it knows that fighting all of NATO, I mean, they're struggling against just Ukraine. It's not a battle they would win at the moment. They want to keep us out.
Justin Crump speaking to me from Washington, D.C. Today's missile strike by Russia was, as I said, in the eastern city of Dnipro. That's where our correspondent Paul Adams has just been. How are people there feeling about another tough winter approaching? And also the chances of a shift in strategic support from the United States once Donald Trump takes office.
Russia's slow, grinding offensive in the east is driving a tide of human misery in front of it. In trains, buses, ambulances and private cars, civilians are fleeing as one by one their towns and villages come under fire and are occupied. Almost 3 years into this war, Ukrainians are still on the move. We're on a train that started its journey in the besieged city of Pokrovsk. It's dimly lit and, for the most part, silent.
There are about a dozen evacuees on the train with us. They are utterly exhausted. They haven't slept, they haven't washed in days. They clung on as long as they could, but finally decided they simply had to leave. Some of them know where they're going, others don't really. And of course, they have absolutely no idea about what the future holds. They're dimly aware that change is in the air and that soon there'll be a new president in the White House. But like all of us, they don't really know what that means.
Ukraine is falling into the abyss.
Yulia has just fled her home. She has a vacant 1,000-yard stare.
I'm not really into politics, and I haven't watched TV for 5 years. That's why I have no interest in delving into politics. I don't trust any of the presidents.
In a reception center in Pavlograd, more evacuees from the front being looked after by volunteers. Anastasia is here with her husband, 2 sons, a cat and a dog. The family held on in their village as long as they could, but with explosions all around, shops closed and roads cut off one by one, they finally fled.
I was living in constant fear. I was thinking going to sleep, if I would wake up or not. It was very scary, but we lived. We didn't have a choice. And after the last hit, that was it. It was enough for me.
People say that there's a new president coming in America and maybe things will change quickly. What do you think?
We hope things will be better and the war will end, that people will not be killed and homes will not be destroyed anymore. I hope to go back home. I hope the new president will be better than the current one.
The new president, Donald Trump, already making himself felt here amid the misery and fatigue. Opinion polls paint a mixed picture, but show that more and more Ukrainians want this war to end soon, especially here in the East, where the sirens sound several times a day, and a growing minority say they're willing to give up territory to secure peace.
So I think it's naive to assume that you can draw a line and say, okay, Putin, grab it. But stop the war.
But Ukraine's former foreign minister, Dmytro Kuleba, says that's not what Vladimir Putin wants. He wants it all. It's too early even to talk of ceding territory. But what does he make of Donald Trump's airy pledges to end the war?
President Trump will undoubtedly be driven by one goal, to project his strength, his leadership, and to show that he is capable of fixing problems which his predecessor failed to fix. This is the ultimate goal that he is pursuing. This is what people, I believe, often miss in analyzing him, in simplifying him to the guy who just wants to do a good deal. And if projecting strengths will imply defeating Russia, he will focus on defeating Russia.
So walking away from Ukraine, you absolutely think is not an option for Trump.
I walked away from Ukraine. Ukraine fell. This is how America projects its leadership in the world against the country who is the closest ally of my biggest enemies, China and North Korea. This is how it's going to look. As much as the fall of Afghanistan inflicted a severe wound on the foreign policy reputation of the Biden administration, if the scenario that you mentioned is to be entertained by President Trump, Ukraine will become his Afghanistan.
In the stiff breeze of early winter, thousands of flags flutter across Dnipro's vast and expanding cemetery. Nowhere else quite conveys the scale of the disaster this country has endured. Anyone attempting to end this war really should see it first.
And that was Paul Adams reporting from the eastern Ukrainian city of Dnipro. You're listening to NewsHour, live from the BBC.
Available now on the documentary from the BBC World Service.
I'm Jude Shapiro. I'm following the chaplains of Heathrow Airport. I'll be discovering what happens when faith, flight and the stresses of Europe's busiest airport combine.
People are so often placed in our path just at the right time.
Listen now by searching for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. We'll hear later in the programme from our climate editor at the COP29 summit. But one call that has been coming out of those talks on managing the global climate has been for countries to prioritise water management in their climate strategies. It's a message which is hitting home in Cape Town in South Africa, a city that not too long ago was enduring a water crisis which left millions without a reliable source of drinking water. So how did the city get by? The BBC's Kisa Wandera has this report.
In Imiza Moyetu, an informal settlement in Cape Town, 48-year-old Nobuhle Blai makes the journey to and from a shared water point several times a day.
But just a few years ago, residents here were faced with an unimaginable reality. Day zero, which would have meant that the city would have completely run out of water.
I told my children to use a small container and share the water to wash their faces, and I'll tell them that they must use another container to collect the water they've already used so that we can use it to flush the toilet when going there.
In Hart Bay, a suburban area in Cape Town, Shala Noton, a vegetable farmer, shows us around her farm. Before the drought, water use in suburban areas like Hart Bay was a lot less efficient. Now, Shala and her community are living by new rules: reuse, recycle, and conserve as much as possible.
We've tried to turn our grey water that's relatively clean, that's what we use to water our garden. We've been lucky that we could afford big JoJo tanks. We collect rainwater.
It did not stop at individual level. Cape Town's leadership embraced innovation, tapping into underground aquifers and recycling wastewater to secure its future. The Zandvliet Wastewater Treatment Works processes 90 million litres of water daily. Jordan Hill-Lewis is the mayor of Cape Town.
We are investing in new sources of water for Cape Town with the aim of replacing about a third, about 33% of our water need from non-rainfall sources, which will make us much less vulnerable to drought conditions in the coming decades.
One of the city's key strategies is utilizing the vast Table Mountain Aquifer, a hidden reserve deep beneath Cape Town. Professor Kevin Winter is a lead researcher at the University of Cape Town's Future Water Institute.
I think we've seen plenty of cities that are using groundwater. If you go to some of the northern Scandinavian countries, for instance, their water supply is entirely from the ground and highly regulated and controlled and managed. All over Africa, groundwater is well known as a source of water.
Back in Imiza Moyetu, Nobuhle's day is not over. She'll make one more trip to the water point before nightfall. But the shift in her mindset and in her community is irreversible.
And that was Akisa Wandera reporting from Cape Town. You're with the BBC World Service and NewsHour, live from London, with me, Tim Franks. Donald Trump has been making some attention-grabbing, controversy-stirring nominations for the top jobs in his next administration. One of the grabbiest and most controversial has just announced that he's pulling out of the process before senators have the chance to question him and decide whether they approve his appointment. Matt Gaetz said he was no longer going to try to become Attorney General, the country's top law officer and the boss at the Department of Justice. The former Republican Congressman, Mr. Gaetz, had been under investigation by the House of Representatives Ethics Committee. Gary O'Donoghue is our North America correspondent. Why had Mr. Gaetz decided now to withdraw?
I think it really comes down to the maths. Don't forget, every cabinet nominee, plus a bunch of others, has to get approved by the Senate before they can take up their job. And while the Republicans do have a majority in the Senate, it's about 53-47. And there were enough worried Republicans in the Senate who were prepared to say so to make his confirmation far from certain just a week after it was announced. So I think that, along with these allegations that were swirling around, doubts over whether he was, you know, qualified for that job, and also because he'd made plenty of Republican enemies in Congress. He was part of the small cabal that unseated the former Speaker, Kevin McCarthy. So he didn't have a big sort of reservoir of goodwill to draw on. And I think all that kind of coalesced into a realization that it was going to be a bun fight that they didn't want.
In terms of the job that he was slated to do, Attorney General, it sounds rather dry, but it's quite a big gig in the US, isn't it?
It's an even bigger gig if you're Donald Trump, because the transition team made it very clear that this was their most important pick. And the reason for that is Donald Trump has this visceral hatred, dislike, distrust of the Department of Justice, which runs all federal law enforcement in this country. He believes that that department was responsible for many of his woes. Indeed, it's a department that brought two criminal prosecutions against him. It's also a department under one of his own nominees in his first term that instituted the special counsel inquiry into links with Russia, of course. So he really wanted someone who was going to shake that place up and govern it in according to his lights only. And that's why he picked a sort of bomb thrower like Matt Gaetz to do that. And I think he thought perhaps that he had enough sway, control, grip on the Republican Party to force this through. But it turns out he didn't. And that's a blow for him.
Right. I guess it also then raises the question of what might happen with his other controversial picks, of which there are several.
Yeah, I mean, Matt Gaetz was the most controversial of quite a controversial bunch, not least people like Tulsi Gabbard, who's been nominated for Director of National Intelligence. Now, bear in mind, top intelligence job in the country, in the intelligence establishment here, accused of being a sort of Russia sympathizer, of having sort of unwise meetings with foreign leaders, of spreading this and that. That's one. Also, the nomination for Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, who's facing his own series of allegations around sexual impropriety, although no charges brought against him like Matt Gaetz, all of whom deny these allegations, of course. And the issue here, I think, and we won't know this, I don't think, until in the coming days, is does this lead senators to think, OK, we've drawn some blood, we'll give him what he wants now? Or does this embolden them and make them think, actually, they flinched pretty quick, so we can insist on examining people and perhaps getting some more middle of the road or sort of normal nominees through.
Gary O'Donoghue speaking to me from the Washington Bureau after Matt Gaetz withdrew his nomination for Attorney General. Brazil's federal police have formally charged the former president Jair Bolsonaro of being part of an alleged conspiracy to stage a coup after he lost the election in 2022 to Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. He and his supporters insisted that that election had been stolen from him. And in January 2023, a week after Lula took office, some of those supporters rioted in the capital, Brasilia. Laís Martins is following the case for the Intercept news website. She's based in São Paulo.
Bolsonaro is accused of first knowing that people under him were plotting to stage this coup, were plotting to assassinate Lula and the vice president Geraldo Alckmin and also the Supreme Court justice, and that Bolsonaro also had the role of analyzing and making changes to this, what they're calling a coup document, which was a decree that would somehow consummate the coup. So the conclusion of the federal police is that Bolsonaro knew and participated in the organization of this coup.
And this coup was supposed to happen in what way? Are there details from the police as to sort of to what lengths the alleged coup plotters were going to go?
Yes, there is. So the police has concluded that this coup would happen first with the assassination of Lula and his vice president as to eliminate them from power. They would also assassinate the Supreme Court Justice, Alexandre de Moraes, who is seen as an enemy of Bolsonaro and people allied to him. And then with the assassination, they would put into government or they would install this type of temporary cabinet, which would be led by military ministers to supposedly investigate the crimes against Lula. And then from then on, they would consummate power with this cabinet in place.
These are incredibly serious charges, and the level of that coup plotting that you described the police are alleging happened is extremely serious as well. When might he stand trial?
So the next step is now the federal police has just today concluded this investigation, and they will be delivering this report to the attorney general. The Attorney General is then in charge with delivering a complaint to the Supreme Court. And then the Supreme Court justices will decide collectively if there are enough arguments, enough evidence to accept the complaint. From then on, Bolsonaro and all the others, there are 36 others who have been indicted today, they move from being accused to being defendants. They're then authorized to present a defense, if I'm not mistaken, a written defense, and then the Supreme Court justices will decide. The local media here has been reporting that justices want to have this sometime in 2025, because 2026 is an election year in Brazil. We're again going to be voting for president. And they're very concerned that if this spills into 2026, they will then be accused of election interference, which is something that the Supreme Court has already been somehow grappling with in the past election. So they want to avoid that by having this decision started and finished in 2025. At the moment, Bolsonaro cannot run in 2026. He was deemed ineligible in 2023 because of, well, some type of abuse of power during his presidency. But he's not a viable option for 2026.
Lais Martins in São Paulo, and for his part, Jair Bolsonaro has just criticised the people in charge of the investigation, and he has vowed to fight all the charges. Australia's Parliament has started debating what it calls world-first legislation to restrict children under the age of 16 from accessing social media apps like Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat and TikTok. The new legislation needs to pass both houses before it becomes law, and the social media companies will have at least a year to come up with ways to prevent children from getting onto their platforms. Otherwise, they could face fines of up to $33 million. Our correspondent Katie Watson has this report from Sydney.
This is about protecting young people, not punishing or isolating them.
Australia's Communications Minister Michelle Rowland made the government's position very clear. For too many children, she said, social media is harmful.
This bill seeks to set a new normative value in society, that accessing social media is not the defining feature of growing up in Australia. Yeah. I commend the bill to the House.
Yeah. Politicians are now debating the legislation in Canberra, but it's a discussion being had well beyond the corridors of power.
It would be helpful for not using your phone all the time, but it's not really good for communities. Some people need to have communities online.
Honestly, I think it's a good thing. I think that kids generally just have a bit too much access to the internet, and there's a lot of really terrible influences online.
I make nail polish for boys. Nail polish, it's not very accepting for guys. Some people get bullied, will get targeted.
But not everyone is so upbeat. Lucas Lane is known as Glossy Boys online, sharing tips for boys who like wearing nail polish. He started at just 12 and has grown a community as well as a business. He and his mum Brianna, who helps him, think the ban is badly thought out.
First, I just didn't think it was a threat because, you know, it's just angry old people like, oh, ban social media. But now this is becoming a threat. And I didn't feel consulted. My mum, did you feel consulted?
Absolutely not.
This is affecting me, not the people making this law.
If you have a blanket ban, what you're doing is you're taking choices away from young people.
I want to see kids off their devices and onto the footy fields and the swimming pools and the tennis courts.
It was back in September that Prime Minister Anthony Albanese first mooted the idea of a social media ban. The proposal captured attention. Governments across the world are all grappling with the same issues of how best to protect children online. Dr. Catherine Page Jeffrey from the University of Sydney says it's the wrong approach.
We need to bring in young people, and of course we need to acknowledge the rights, the perspectives, the agency of young people. The UN Convention on the Rights of the Child points out that young people are entitled to participation and that all these things apply to the digital world as well. And everyone seems to be forgetting that.
Many people want to know how it'll work. The government said the companies will be legally required to protect Australians from harm. They've now got a big chunk of time to come up with ways of doing that. Age verification is one suggestion. Daniel Angus is the Professor of Digital Communication at the Queensland University of Technology.
So there are two kinds of age verification that might be put into play. One is age verification proper, which is the handing over of personal details like passports, driver's licenses, other forms of ID. That's problematic. In some ways, we're asking all of Australia to hand over those details if they want to be online, not just children. The other technology being talked about is age assurance, and that's the use of facial recognition or other kinds of AI. That is riddled with error. It still carries racial bias, gender bias, age bias, and is not a solution to this issue.
Hi, I'm Taylor, and I'd like to tell you a story about the time I accidentally shared way too much online.
Australia's touting it as a world first ban. Who will be next? But perhaps more importantly, how will the platform step up to the new restrictions?
Be careful what you share on the internet, because once it's out there, it's out there.
That report came from our correspondent in Sydney, Katie Watson. You're listening to NewsHour, live from the BBC. You're with NewsHour, live from the BBC in London. I'm Tim Franks. The COP29 UN climate talks in Azerbaijan are meant to draw to a close on Friday, but as is often the case at these meetings, there is currently deadlock over a final deal. The key task is to agree on a new target to replace the $100 billion a year that rich nations pledge to help poorer countries fight climate change. One draft suggests that that figure could be in the trillions of dollars. Britain and Brazil have been asked to try to come up with a compromise that the nearly 200 countries can sign up to. Our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt, is at the meeting in the Azerbaijani capital, Baku.
What even is a trillion? A million seconds is 11 and a half days. A billion seconds is 31 years. A trillion seconds is 31,000 years. $1 trillion is a lot of money. So how on earth can you raise that kind of cash? Now, traditionally, you'd pass around the hat, ask developed countries, rich countries, to cough up a bit more. But they only pay developing countries about $40 billion a year in climate finance at the moment.
Every COP must make progress irrespective of the geopolitical dynamics.
Mia Motley, the Prime Minister of Barbados, is leading a reform process.
Rich countries must deliver on their commitments.
She's argued with success that the international development banks, the IMF, the World Bank and others could and should be delivering more money.
These are institutions that were founded post-World War II, where all the governments of the world pool their money.
Joe Thwaites is a climate finance expert with a US environmental group.
With that money and with the backing of all the world's governments, including some with brilliant credit ratings, they can go to private capital markets and borrow money very, very cheaply.
The idea is they could borrow more and therefore lend more out at cheap rates.
You can triple the size of the multilateral development banks. So you could grow them to about $390 billion a year.
Now we're making progress. That cash could be used to unlock even more money, say a team of eminent economists tasked by the UN with exploring the climate finance issue.
The multiplier effect. Yes, so you put $1, you get $20 out if you have a guarantee.
Vera Songwe from Cameroon is one of those economists. She says we shouldn't forget that there's potentially a lot of profit in clean energy in the developing world. One important reason private investors are wary is interest rates are often far higher there. But a bit of money up front,
it guarantees the investment. It tells the investor there is not going to be any change of policy, change of price, or change of the environment.
Less risk.
But if that happens, I am going to pay you for it happening, any money that you've lost. So it takes the risk away.
And the interest rate falls.
And the interest rate falls. And capital flows in.
Songwe and her colleagues say this could generate as much as $500 billion a year of private investment in the years after 2030. And there are other, even more innovative ideas bouncing around this conference. Levies on aviation, on shipping, on billionaires. They may be long shots, but each one could raise tens of billions a year. So while a trillion really is a very large amount of money, the prospect of raising it may not be as alarming as it sounds.
Brilliant. Justin Rowlatt, our climate editor in Baku. Now, let me ask you whether this is art, or is it comedy, or is it both?
At $5 million for the banana, here it is. These are words I never thought I'd say. $5 million for a banana. Don't let it slip away.
Wonderful stuff. So it has come to pass. The artwork sold at auction for more than $5 million is indeed a banana stuck to a wall with duct tape. The work was made by the artist Maurizio Catalan in 2019, one of three original editions, no less. It was called Comedian, and the person who stumped up the cash is a crypto entrepreneur called Justin Sun, who has promised to eat the banana before it goes off. Elizabeth Fullerton is an art critic. She's been speaking to my sceptical colleague, James Menendez.
It's quite a fruity work, if you think about it. It's a phallic symbol. There's a kind of puerile humour to it. But it's also subversive, isn't it? It's a bit like Piero Manzoni's 90 cans of excrement that he made that were supposed to be valued according to their weight in gold. And at the same time, no one even knew if they really were, if they really did have excrement inside them. Here you've got a banana that two people have already eaten, two artists have already eaten, taken off the wall and eaten. I had a banana today for breakfast. You know, it's a pretty normal thing. And I think the artist is poking fun at the art world, at the art market, and saying, just how much are people prepared to pay for something really, really ordinary that I've just stuck up on the wall and decided is art?
So the joke is on who? The joke is on the person who bought it, this crypto entrepreneur, is it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, definitely he's poking fun at the art market and its excesses. But of course, it has a more serious side too. I mean, it's funny, but it's also a little bit grotesque. There's something gross about the idea of paying $6 million or $5 million for a banana taped to a wall. What else could that buy in terms of, think of the food and medicine that could be bought for people in Gaza with that money? Or there's so much that could be done with that money and put to a good cause. But at the same time, this entrepreneur has bought himself 5 minutes in the spotlight in a way. It's kind of buying the hype.
And it's so strange because it is a fresh banana. I mean, it's not even buying something that would last. I mean, thinking about sort of, you know, other provocative art objects that, you know, have raised a lot of money in the past, like the one you mentioned. I was also thinking about Merritt Oppenheim's third cup as well. I mean, these things are objects that will stand the test of the time. But I mean, he said he's going to eat this banana and he'll have to replace it himself. Does that make him part of the artwork then as well, or just a mug?
Personally, I think it makes him a mug, but it's a really perfect artwork for our time. It's a perfect artwork for a world of excess and spectacle, material excess and spectacle. I mean, it will buy him a little bit more fame and time on social media if he films himself eating it. This can run and run. It's not just one banana, as we saw when people did eat it in different art fair booths, you know, and they just replaced it because you're buying the concept.
Not just a banana, you're buying the concept. Elizabeth Fullerton, art critic, speaking to what can I say? He was sceptical, but he was also open-minded. Best place to be for a journalist. James Menendez, my colleague. That's it from this edition of NewsHour. From me, Tim Franks, and the rest of the team here in London, thanks for your company.
Available now on the documentary from the BBC World Service.
I'm Jude Shapiro. I'm following the chaplains of Heathrow Airport. I'll be discovering what happens when faith, flight, and the stresses of Europe's busiest airport combine.
People are so often placed in our path just at the right time.
Listen now by searching for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.